I'm Malcolm Bernstein. It's time for the American Israelite program, The News of the Jews. We're going to start off today with some of the continuing information about the Amberley Village changes at Amberley Green. What started out as a somewhat tense opening to a special council meeting of the Amberley Village on Monday, June 24th, eventually dissolved into one of cool-headed consideration. The special council meeting was called to discuss plans for the Mayor's and Jewish Community Center's proposed use of Amberley Green. Having kicked off the meeting by setting out with a mission of using the time to work through the comments, Mayor Tom Musing said, "I want to have clarity out of today as to how to go forward." Four residents then voiced their concerns about the plans the JCC and Amberley Village were putting together, including one resident who requested that council members disclose if they were Jewish Center members. Following the concerns, all of the written comments that had been submitted to Amberley were shared, having yielded more than 80 comments that came in via email, written comments, and online submissions. This provided an opportunity for all the people in the room, especially the council members, to consider the concerns that residents shared. Village Manager Scott Larmer and his staff at CORE categorized the comments and concerns into 8 areas, most of which concerned either the benefits and amenities of Amberley Green for the residents, or the possibility of leveraging Amberley Green for sufficient and worthwhile revenue generation for the village. And I should mention, of course, that Amberley Green is the former Crest Hills property located at the corner of Galbraith and Ridge Road at the southwest corner. One area, however, that was important was the desire for more information, which was no surprise to the staff, said Larmer, as residents recognize that they need more information. I think these comments surface a lot of things that people like and don't like. Following on the heels of Larmer's sharing of the data, each council member provided their input. Rich Bardak identified the need to manage the conflict between dog people, who want to keep Amberley Green as it is, and camp people, who would like to be able to put Amberley Green to use for their children. Bardak also articulated that future maintenance costs need to be fleshed out for Amberley Green. Councilmember Alida Kameen said the value overwhelmingly is that people want to use the land as they are already using it. We have a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of work ahead of us. On the heels of his fellow council members' comments, Muthing went through a list of information, thoughts, and comments of his own, including mentioning that the demand for the land is not as high as it had been when the village acquired it. "It is the right thing to work this deal," he said. "The JCC and the Jewish community are critical to Amberley Village. The JCC has been one of the best things to happen to Amberley Village. While there had been some ideas of a master plan years ago, people have been reluctant to do a master plan," Larmer said, "as it has developed to become a sort of fluid over the years." Larmer urged some movement on these plans. "If we're interested, we need to move forward. Otherwise, we'll be sitting here in 5 years with this land." Larmer also identified the JCC as a good business partner and that Amberley Village should be willing to work with the JCC in moving forward. "Otherwise, this analysis paralysis could be detrimental both to the village's future plans with Amberley Green and to its finances." With some significant questions still left to answer concerning both Amberley Green financial commitments and considerations, as well as specifics of any potential deal with the JCC, there is much left that will need to happen before any deals can be made. Clear results of the special council meeting are that Amberley Village still has much to consider before going forward with any deals with the JCC, and that it plans on making sure it communicates to its residents about this information. A man The white supremacist, who rammed his car into a group of counter-protesters at a far-right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer, has asked a judge for mercy. Attorneys for James Alex Fields, Jr. blamed his behavior in part on the trauma he suffered by knowing that his Jewish grandfather had murdered his grandmother before committing suicide. Fields' attorneys made the claim in a sentencing memo submitted to the U.S. District Court in Richmond, Virginia on June 14th. Fields is scheduled to be sentenced on June 28th after Field pleading guilty in March to 29 federal hate crime charges and admitting that he intentionally drove his speeding car into a crowd of anti-racism protesters. Under the Plays deal, prosecutors agreed not to seek the death penalty against Fields. He could face life in prison under federal sentencing guidelines. Prosecutors in their sentencing memo noted years of documented racist and anti-Semitic behavior by Fields, which they said included keeping a picture of Adolf Hitler on his bedside table. They also report that he has shown no remorse for his actions and that a life sentence would deter others from similar actions. A jury in Fields' state trial in December 2018 found him guilty of first-degree murder and 9 lesser counts. The jury in the state conviction recommended life in prison plus 419 years. And a Boston rabbi has suggested that congregants bring guns to the synagogue. A rabbi in Boston has asked congregants to consider bringing guns to religious services as a form of protection in response to recent shootings at synagogues across the country. Rabbi Dan Rodkin of Shalom House in Brighton, a Boston neighborhood with a large number of Russian-speaking Jews, told public radio station WBUR that the rise in hate crimes across the country and the loss of life at the Chabad at Poway and the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh influenced his thinking. Rodkin fears that increased safety measures implemented at the Shalom House, including security cameras, reinforced glass windows, and panic buttons, are no longer significant protection. The rabbi said the actions of an off-duty officer at the Poway Chabad Center, where one woman was killed, may have prevented further casualties. He said, "I know it sounds terrible, but I think it's a very logical approach to the situation we're in. I don't want people to have guns, but I think to protect our families, it's a necessity now." Several of his congregants, including former soldiers and retired police, are now carrying guns into the daily services at the synagogue, which also operates a day school. According to their website, it was founded under the auspices and instruction of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who envisioned the creation of a Jewish school in Boston that would serve needs of the children from non-observant families. Rodkin, who said in the interview that he plans to get a gun and organize training for new firearm owners, was not available for comment. Neil Gold, president of the Massachusetts Board of Rabbis, told WBUR that he understands the concerns about security, but said individuals in synagogues have to balance a tension between safety and the Jewish tenet of welcoming the stranger. Recent violence targeting Jewish houses of worship has heightened concern at synagogues in Massachusetts and across the country, he said. Massachusetts has seen a rise in anti-Semitic incidents and hate crimes, including recent arson attacks against 2 Boston area Chabad centers. Jeremy Yaman, director of security and operations at the Combined Jewish Philanthropies of Greater Boston, who advises the area's Jewish institutions, told the radio station that he has heard from other synagogues who are weighing the same question about congregants carrying guns. He cautioned that the decision to carry a gun is not simple, and that even those trained with firearms would face a myriad of uncertainties if they confronted an active shooter in their synagogue. Let's take a look at this week's Parsha. It is Shelach, Numbers 13:1 to 15:41. As the portion of this from Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, of course, as always. As the portion of Shelach opens, we read how God commands the Israelites to send ahead men to spy out and explore the land of Israel. And we know the tragic results of the spy mission. The report which emerged from 10 out of 12 was negative and discouraging, which only served to divert the Israelites from their God-given mission of the conquest of the land of Israel. Hence, the agonizing question which this portion evokes is, why did God command the sending of the scouts in the first place? Why risk a rebellion in the ranks by requesting a committee report, which may well go against the divine will to conquer and settle Israel? A totally different perspective, not only as to why God commanded Moses to send out the scouts, but much more profoundly as to how God operates in the world and why, is to be found in a remarkable interpretation given by Rabbeinu Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, who lived from 1823 to 1900. He was a great Hasidic master and made commentary called Pre-Tzadok. He points out a striking analogy between the incident of the scouts and the gift of the second tablets, which came as a result of the sin of the golden calf, both conceptually as well as textually. In both cases, the Almighty saw the necessity of involving, even to the extent of establishing a partnership with, the people, the nation of Israel. In what way were the second tablets an improvement on the first tablets, which Moses smashed, and which God congratulated him for smashing? That in Exodus 34:1 and referred to in Talmud Yevamot 62a. What was built into the second tablets, which would be more likely to prevent a fiasco of the proportion of the sin of the golden calf, which occurred only 40 days after the gift of the first tablets, the fact that the first tablets had been written with the finger of God and were in actuality the very script of the divine, whereas the second tablets were hewn out by Moses and therefore created as a result of human involvement, suggests the difference. The first tablets were the product of divine creativity alone. The second tablets involved human cooperation, setting the stage for rabbinical interpretation, decrees, and enactments, which are such a major portion of what we call the oral law. The oral law not only accepts but requires the direct participation of rabbinic leadership, even the involvement of the masses of committed Jews. This from the Pre-Tzadok already referred to on Exodus Ki Tisa 3 and on Numbers Shelach 2. Of course, we believe that the major principles and salient laws of the oral Torah were also given by God. However, the sages of each generation must actively interpret the Torah and often plumb from its depths great innovative concepts necessary for the needs of that generation. Indeed, in a stunning Talmudic passage, the rules of rabbinical exegesis can even cause the Almighty Himself to accept a decision of the majority of the sages, causing him, as it were, to cry out, "My children have conquered me." Bava Metzia 39b. The very words with which God commands Moses to hew out the second tablets, Pasal Lecha, also contain a nuance. You, Moses, have the authority and the obligation to determine whether an activity or object is pasul, improper and invalid. The sages are given the power to add decrees and enactments, gezerot and tachanot, to the body of the Torah, many of which, such as lighting candles on the eve of the Sabbath and festivals, the candling of the Hanukkah menorah, and the reading of the Purim Megillah, have become major expressions of our Torah commitment and lifestyle. However, no such decrees or enactments can become part and parcel of the Torah of Israel without the endorsement of the majority of the committed people who have the right of acceptance or rejection. The masses of committed people, the hoi polloi, or hamon ha'am, have also initiated customs throughout the generations which assume the status of Torah law. Mincha Yisrael dinhu, the customs of Israel are law. All of this suggests a Torah which is not the product of ossified paternalism, as divinely perfect as such a Torah might be, but is rather the result of a living partnership between God and his people. Apparently, the Almighty believed, after the tragic trauma of the golden calf, that only a Torah which would involve the active participation of the Israelites could survive the seductive pitfalls of idolatry and immorality. Fascinatingly enough, the phrase Pesal Lecha from Exodus 34:1 parallels the words God used to command the scouts, Shalach Lecha, send out for yourselves, in the beginning of our Torah portion. God apparently understood that a mission as important as the conquest of Israel could not take place without the enthusiastic approbation and active participation of the people. Of course, opening up the process, be it Torah interpretation or the appointment of a Renaissance committee, is fraught with danger. But it was a chance that God understood had to be taken if he desired his nation to be more than a marching robots. He didn't want us to receive a Torah on a silver platter or be brought into the promised land on eagle's wings. He realized that despite the inherent risk which came from involving the people, excluding them would be a more likely prescription for disaster. Just as a wise parent and a sagacious educator understand that children and students must be involved in the process so that hopefully they will continue the path even after they achieve independence, the Almighty set the stage for our continuous devotion to Torah and our third return to Israel, despite our many setbacks, by insisting on the participation of his people. Shabbat Shalom from Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Chancellor Emeritus of Orator Stone and Chief Rabbi of Ephrat Israel. What else is happening out there in the world? The Cavaliers, the Cleveland Cavaliers, have named the University of California, Berkeley's Lindsay Gottlieb as an assistant coach, making her the first women's collegiate head coach signed to an NBA staff. Gottlieb, who was inducted into the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame in Northern California in 2016, joins the Cavaliers after 8 years as head coach of the Cal women's basketball team. John Bylan, formerly coach of the University of Michigan men's team, was named head coach at the Cavaliers last month. At Cal, Gottlieb led the Golden Bears to a 179-89 record, including a trip to the 2013 NCAA Final Four after taking the helm in 2011-12. Gottlieb, who's 41, is believed to be the eighth woman hired as an assistant coach or player development staffer for an NBA team, but none had held the top position at a major basketball power like Cal. Cavaliers general manager Kobe Altman, who is also Jewish, in a news release said Coach Gottlieb brings a depth of basketball knowledge, leadership and perspective, and approach to her craft that will fit very well with our team and staff alike. We're fortunate she was willing to leave her role as head coach at such a solid and successful program at Cal. Born and raised in Scarsdale, New York, she's the daughter of Stephen Gottlieb, who was a Supreme Court Justice and New York Assistant Assemblyman. Both of her parents are deceased. She played basketball at Brown University and earned her master's degree in philosophy of education while attending Syracuse. Also in sports, Israeli rhythmic gymnast Linoy Asheron won 2 gold medals at the 2019 European Games in Minsk in the ball event and the club event, both held on June 23rd. And she also won a silver medal during the competition on June 22nd. Nearly 1 in 5 Americans say small businesses should be able to refuse service to Jews. 19% of Americans think small business owners should be allowed to refuse service to Jews if doing so would violate their religious beliefs. That's an increase in 2014 when 12% of respondents agreed with the statement. Survey found increased support for business owners to refuse service to a number of other groups as well, including gays and lesbians, transgender people, atheists, Muslims, and African Americans. The proportion of Americans who think small businesses should be able to refuse service to gays and lesbians was the highest among all minority groups at 30%. The other groups range from 15% for African Americans to 29% for transgender people. A significantly higher proportion of Republicans approved of service refusals than did Democrats. There was a disruption around the Ben Gurion airport of GPS. Airplanes flying near Israel's Ben Gurion report in recent weeks have been losing their connection, and Israeli officials are blaming Russia. The disruptions have been going on for 3 weeks, but are widely reported earlier this week. Russia's national broadcaster, Khan, reported on Thursday that disruptions have now spread to other countries, including Cyprus, Turkey, and part of the Greek islands. Pilots reportedly have alternative instruments for navigation and landing and do not need to rely on Global Positioning System. Unnamed Israeli security officials have told local media that GPS disruptions, a form of electronic warfare, originate in Syria, where Russian troops and aircraft are fighting on behalf of the country's military and President Bashar Assad. But the Russian ambassador to Israel told Army Radio Thursday that the reports are fake news and could not be taken seriously. The Israel Aviation Authority told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz that the disruptions affect only planes in the air and not ground navigation systems. An aviation source also told the newspaper that the disruptions do not put pilots and passengers at risk. Yesterday evening was the first Democrat debate. Cory Booker was the only Democrat who didn't commit last night to in the first debate to rejoining the Iran deal. Monitors of the debate asked candidates whether they would rejoin the deal President Trump abandoned a year ago. Booker was the only one not to raise his hand. Moderator Savannah Guthrie framed the question by noting the recent escalation between the United States and Iran in the Straits of Hormuz. Booker said Trump was wrong to pull out of the deal, which made Iran's nuclear program more transparent. He said he would not automatically re-enter it, but would instead negotiate for a better deal. I'm not going to stand up on a primary stage and announce that I'm unilaterally or de facto going back to the deal. He voted for the deal in 2015, alienating some of his backers in the pro-Israel community. Candidates Klobuchar and Gabbard, the only others who were permitted to speak on the issue, also said they would seek better terms. Senator Amy Klobuchar said she would seek longer sunset provisions to the deal, meaning longer periods of time in which Iran is not allowed to go back to uranium enrichment. Representative Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii said she would seek to include missile development in the deal. Later in the evening, the candidates were asked to name the greatest political challenge. Most named China. Only Senator Klobuchar mentioned the Middle East. The only significant difference that emerged among the candidates when asked, foreign policy difference that emerged among the candidates when they were asked if the United States should intervene in a genocide if American lives were not threatened. Beto O'Rourke, the first to be asked, said he believed America should intervene, but only as part of an alliance. De Blasio, mayor of New York, rebuked O'Rourke, saying that any president should seek the approval of Congress. Moderators then pivoted to Tim Ryan of Ohio, asking him if the United States should remain in Afghanistan. Ryan said it posed a continuing threat, prompting a rebuke from Representative Gabbard, a veteran whose most distinguished policy is her isolationism. Is that what you will tell parents of those two soldiers killed in Africa, in Afghanistan, that we have to be engaged? As a soldier, I'm telling you that that is unacceptable. And that report was made before the second night of the debates. Jason Kushner having that peace conference in Bahrain brought a minion to a synagogue in Bahrain this week. He mustered a minion of 10 adult Jewish males for morning services Wednesday at the synagogue, which dates back to the 19th century. Participants were among the businessmen, officials, journalists, think tank employees attending the conference. Let's take a quick look at the calendar. Jewish Family Service Strategic Planning Work Group, 8:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Sunday, June 30th at Jewish Family Service. There's a rummage sale at Valley Temple from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Sunday, June 30th also. And the River City Kosher Barbecue Festival, 3 to 7 Northern Hills Synagogue on Sunday. Candle lighting tonight at 8:50. Shabbos is over at 9:51 p.m. on Saturday. This has been the American Israelite Program, the news of the Jews. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. I'll be back with you again next week. Bye-bye.